So, welcome to His Holy Church, X-Space, and today we have a topic of kingdom economics. So, what is kingdom economics, or the economy of the kingdom? How does that work? Well, one of the ways to look at that is to find out how everybody else's systems of economics works. There's all kinds of economic systems out there, have been for, well, at least hundreds of years. We've had a name like, you know, Adam Smith. We can go back to the early days of the American Revolution, where they had Hamiltonian economics. And there's just a variety of economic systems that have been talked about throughout history. One of the things I wrote the other day in reference to the idea of economics, of course, is that the left is in love with the covetous practices of every ruler from Cain to Nimrod or Pharaoh to Caesar. But while they are willing to destroy institutions of merit, they are the first victims after any successful revolution. For evil does not share power. And of course, I also heard, you know, a guy talking to college students, pointing out Mao Zedong, Cuba, Soviet Union. They all looked to the young intellectuals in universities for the original advocates of their communist takeovers of governmental power to create a revolutionary atmosphere, promising a utopia that eventually becomes a dystopia. And the first people they sacrifice are those who wanted to, you know, foment revolution and create this, you know, socialist paradise where there was equality without the stress and strain of obtaining the meritorious position of success. And the reality is, to me, it's amazing because the same people that promote that kind of revolutionary socialist outcome for society are the same people who believe in evolution and survival of the fittest. And of course, survival of the fittest doesn't seem very humanitarian when you're looking at an economic system, which basically says if you don't work, you don't eat, which of course we find in the Bible. But by the same token, the Bible is one of the most humanitarian books there is, depending on how you read it and interpret it. So anyway, I put together some notes on the idea of kingdom economics. And of course, like I said, I mentioned at the beginning, the Adam Smith is, you know, an 18th century father of modern economics. That's one of the titles they give him, advocating for free markets, specialization of limited government intervention, kind of a laissez-faire approach to government. And one of the greatest laissez-faire presidents we ever had was Calvin Coolidge. He always said that the nation was the safest between about 1 o'clock and 2:30, because that's when he took his nap, and he figured that he couldn't do any damage while he was napping. But that necessarily isn't always a good strategy. But his core ideas, Adam Smith's core ideas, notably, are laid out in his book, The Wealth of Nations, and they argue that rational self-interest drives prosperity, where the invisible hand of competition naturally guides resources towards efficiency and consumer benefit. And that can make a lot of sense. You know, people can talk about that for hours. We're not going to do it because we want to get to kingdom economics. But a lot of people I respect a great deal and think a great deal about economic issues, etc. They're big advocates of Adam Smith, but they don't seem to realize that you cannot engage in free markets, even with the idea of specialization, you know, where, you know, maybe you're a blacksmith, and so that's where you pick up your extra funds. You might, in the early 1700s and the 18th century, somebody who was a blacksmith would also be a farmer. And he also might be a bridge builder, at least over small, you know, creeks, etc. He might be a road builder. He might do all kinds of animal husbandry. He might know how to do that. But his cash efforts were maybe blacksmithing. And he might specialize in that. You know, he might make nails, or he might make guns, or he might make horseshoes. He might do all kinds of different things that are, you know, like the earlier blacksmiths who were making armor. That's a very specialized skill. And that skill gave his work by the hour more value, because he put a lot of value and maybe had some natural talent into learning that skill. Now, you can magnify that with all the different things that people might need in society. And of course, today we have societies that produce all kinds of goods. I mean, I'm looking at computer screens. I didn't make those. I don't think I could put, it was kind of a joke around when my kids were growing up. Every time they wanted something, I said, well, we can make that. Because we lived 100 miles from the store, we would make those things. And it made my kids very independent. But when computers came along and my kids wanted to see if they could get a computer, this is early days of computers, my oldest son, who was still pretty young at the time, said, Dad, we can't make it ourselves. I wanted to immediately run out to the shop and build an abacus, because that's one of the original computers, but I just didn't have the time, so I suggested that we do that. But he probably didn't laugh very hard at my joke. But the reality is, that's Adam Smith's market. Free market doesn't work when you're buying and selling with a communist nation, because they're not allowed in a communist nation self-interest, because they're a collective. In a collective, they're constantly removing self-interest. That you can't pursue your self-interest. You have to pursue what the collective says you need to pursue. They're controlling the means of production in a lot more ways than you can imagine. We had a discussion on X with some people early on, when it was often a free-for-all. Now, if anybody ends up wanting to take a mic, ask a question and raise a hand, you can request a mic and be ready to raise your hand and ask a question and maybe even get into a conversation, because we're going to take this all the way up into the Iranian conflict today with the United States, because that's actually a market-driven conflict. There's a lot of factors, but there is a market-driven element to that conflict. And most people have no idea where that conflict is coming from. But we'll get into that. But let's go through some of these ideas. Why can't you have free markets with a communist nation? And of course, that's where America really started going downhill. They didn't feel the downhill plunge, but they began to lose their manufacturing base, which supplied the nation with a great many well-paying jobs, single worker families, where the wife stays home, raises the children, the husband goes to work, and earns enough salary that he can buy a house in 5 to 10 years. And we had that. You know, if you were a carpenter, you could make a wage just as a carpenter with hand tools. Back at the turn of the century, I was born, that where you could make enough money where you could own your own house in 3 to 5 years. You know, a 3 to 5 year mortgage was as much as you could possibly imagine. And the idea, you know, most of the people bought their first car cash. You didn't buy cars on time in the early days. And what was a car? $500? Well, $500 was a sizable portion of the cost of a house. Like I said, in 1945, my folks bought a three-bedroom house in the city of Omaha with wood floors, oak cabinets, dishes in the cupboards, all electrical, well-insulated house for $3,500. And that was, and you could buy houses for a lot less than that. So buying a car for $500, which actually buying the car for $500 was back Model A, Model T kind of automobiles. But that was a sizable amount of money that people had. My own great-grandfather retired at 45 from farming in North Dakota. He had enough money he could retire at 45. This was what was going on in the economy then that allowed such sources of wealth amongst just basic labor-type jobs that where you could raise a family, buy a house. On a single, family income, single income family. Well, there were a lot of factors, and those factors were slowly and steadily removed, many of them in this, 20th century from, 1900, I could tell you events, 1911, 1913, 1933, 1977. By 1979, you had the, Trilateral Commission and the, some of the other institutions that they were creating that were literally writing down and publishing the idea of removing the manufacturing base from the United States, outsourcing it to other countries. This was going to make the whole world prosper, supposedly, but some of those countries they were outsourcing to was like China and other countries that were not necessarily communists, but where the people were so poor, they virtually were serfs still upon the land. And you really can't have free trade with those nations either. Doesn't have to just be a communist or a socialist nation, but anywhere where the people do not really have that ability to exercise a rational self-interest and self-determination. Self-determination is not a part of their political environment, and so therefore it's not a part of their economic environment. You have the key components of the Smean economics is this invisible hand of individuals pursuing their own self-interest. Another thing is the division of labor, that specialization, where everybody is not a serf on the land, that you might be a stone cutter, you might be a barrel maker, you might be a winemaker, you might do lots of other more specialized work. And of course, just being in these different fields going to create an unequal level of earning power. But you want to create an earning power that becomes uniformly enough so that people can make a living. There's always going to be some people who can't run their own business, can't really learn a trade. They're mentally or maybe even physically incapable of doing any of the trades that could provide a family living. They might have to be a servant in somebody else's house or an employee in somebody else's business. And they might be very good at it. I saw a welder the other day that was welding. And the fellow worker was being told that when you talk to this welder, you have to talk very slowly because he has difficulty in communicating. He didn't have very good communicating skills. But when you put him on a welding job and he knows what he has to do, there is no better welder on the job site because he had this because he didn't have the mental capacity to think about lots of different things and multitask and all the things you have to do sometimes when you're running a business, he could focus on running that bead, and you could give him bead to do, weld a pipe, whatever, and he would do an absolutely meticulous, excellent job. So there are places for people of all sorts of meritorious abilities in an economy, but again, it has to be an economy where the individual is allowed to pursue his own self-interest. And so you get that in a capitalist society, but as I've said before, because Adam Smith is dealing with capitalism, in a capitalist society, that capitalism is what you produce is yours. The labor that you work at, and the whatever you accomplish with that, whatever meritorious ability you have, the fruit of that labor, if you've made an agreement as an employee or whatever, that should be yours. But it's not a political system. Capitalism is not a political system. Socialism is a political system. And I was started to say, we had a conversation where I pointed out that socialism, somebody controls the means of production. And of course, immediately he said, oh no, you don't even know what socialism is because you said this phrase that you often find in the description of communism. And, you find it before Marx, but you find it in the system of communism, and it's often attributed to Marx. But the reality is, in socialism, and if you, let's go back to the communism. In communism, when they say control the means of production, they specifically state this does not include the labor of the people. I don't know how they come to that conclusion, because that isn't the case in reality. Because it not only controls the labor of the people, it controls the life of the people. But in all production, the means of production is primarily the labor of the individual. Yes, it may include steel, it may include iron, it may include wood, it may include natural resources, it may include machinery and factories, etc. And you call that the means of production. But all the factories in the world don't produce anything unless you have a man's labor. At least right now I can say that. I guess they're making robots, and maybe someday the robots will make other robots. But it's the man's labor that turns that factory, those raw materials, into a product. So in socialism, if you have a right to a percentage of the labor of an individual, you're controlling the means of production by at least that portion. When we were in the bondage of Egypt, the government controlled 20% of the labor of the people. Now, they might be able to decide I'm going to make bricks, or they might be able to decide that I'm going to grow wheat or barley or some other commodity, but 20% of whatever he produced was going to be controlled by the state. It was going to be turned over to the state. So yes, he didn't have the ability to pursue his self-interest with at least 20% of his labor. So socialism does control a portion of the means of production. And of course, socialism also ends up being a controlled economy. It all depends on levels. You know, FDR was a socialist. Adolf Hitler was, they're both democratic socialists. And that was interesting, but they ended up in a war against each other. LBJ really wasn't a socialist, but he used socialist programs. This great society was a socialist program. FDR's Social Security. I mean, it's even in the name, Social Security. You have to take, originally it was like 1.5% of your labor, give it to the government, and the government was going to supply or provide supposedly Social Security with those funds. But it was more than that, but we'll get into that some other time. But the reality is that was a percentage of your labor you no longer were going to have control over. Somebody else was going to control it. Now it's up to over 14% for the same payment into Social Security. Originally it was half by you, half by your employer, and if you were self-employed, you didn't have to pay the other half, but then you had to pay the other half. It's gradually been increasing, plus the fact that your wages at a dollar an hour used to be very adequate wages. If your wages was a dollar an hour and you could buy a home with $1,000 back in the 1900s, you could easily do that. Then you will probably work 2,000, 3,000 hours in a given year. And if you don't eat it all up, you know, you could buy your meal for, you know, and a loaf of bread for a penny. So yeah, at a dollar an hour, you could own your own home after a year or two. And so it was adequate wage, but because of inflation, now you might have to have $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 to buy a comparable home today and to live today. So as you graduated up, and so now you can't get by on a dollar an hour, you have to make, you know, $50,000, $70,000, $100,000 a year, and that percentage that you have to pay in keeps going up. Plus, it gets you into the graduated income tax. So, capitalism, this, the key thing that we want to stay on this topic of economics, capitalism is an economic system where you produce it, it belongs to you. And theoretically, you would, you know, you go out and you do a dollar's worth of work, and now you don't have that labor anymore. You gave it up to an employer and he paid you a dollar. He actually gave you an ounce of silver, a dollar. And that's now capital you can put in your pocket. And it represents that labor is now carried around in your pocket. If you're working for a dollar a day or a dollar an hour, you're working for a dollar an hour, maybe he gave you $8. You know, cowboy wages in the 1900s was anywhere between $30 and $50 a month. You'd get room and board, but board was sometimes sleeping in a bedroll. But a guy could, you know, because he doesn't have any place to spend the money, he can actually make money and end up doing that for 3 or 4 years and actually go out and buy a ranch with the money he made at $40 an hour, $40 a month. And so this is part of understanding economics is the value of the money. We have the value of the labor, the value of the freedom to pursue your own interest, your own self-interest, and you get paid in something we can actually call capital. Something that has value to storekeepers and to, you know, you go buy somebody's ranch or their farm or their house or their shack. You can exchange that money you got for that labor. So that's economics. But the Bible tells us that you have to have just weights and measures. Well, all that's kind of gone away too. Can you really have Adam Smith's, you know, system of economics if you don't have just weights and measures? Because, you know, free market, you have also competition, minimal government interference, and it's the last characteristic is a source of wealth. Well, if they're giving you, they're paying you in money that is losing value as you walk out the door, then you don't have a just weight and measure in your pocket. You have a note in your pocket. So the removal of just weights, gold and silver, copper, I mean, we could have all kinds of different kinds of substantive money today. You get stocks and bonds theoretically can be considered more substance than Federal Reserve notes are today. So removing these things changes the equation of this Adam Smith economy. Capitalism is not cause or theory, but it is a distinctive doctrine that accepts as sacred the distinct and a natural right of private ownership, control, and operation of the means of production and their beneficial use of that which is produced. And of course there's Keynesian economics, fiscal domination economics, lots of different forms of these ways in which they put all these things together. But this capitalism requires that you actually have capital, a money of value, that you actually own your labor, and that you have a way of identifying what you own. Like if you go out and you have some land, you fenced it off, you've established ownership, you planted trees, and now you are saying, well, if you come on, I'll let you log these trees. If I get 10% of your sale of these trees to the sawmill. And so, you know, whatever the deal is, you make that deal. He has a property right because he owns the land upon which the trees grew. You will now have a property right as you cut the trees down, limb them up, load them on your truck, and haul them to the mill. The mill will have a property right when they pay you for the raw material. They'll change the raw material into lumber or what have you. I mean, you can go out and literally buy a walnut tree, and they will come out and dig up the roots, the tree, all the branches. They'll take it away because they're going to make everything from knife handles to rifle stocks to what have you out of that walnut tree. Every ounce of that tree is going to be turned into some sort of a product. It's not just going to be sawed up into labor. Very specialized thing, and it produces a value that is greater than the tree was when it was just standing in the on the property of the owner. So you have to have a way of not only measuring the value of things, and of course part of that is going to be the money system you have, you know, ounce of silver, ounce of gold, ounce of platinum, ounce of copper, you know, a fraction of copper, etc., etc. You know, the reason they don't have copper pennies anymore is that copper pennies are worth more. 100 copper pennies is worth more than a dollar. And of course, this actually took place during the 70s. There's a number of things that have, like I say, that have been taking place. So we kind of looked at some of the economic systems. I haven't really talked about what, and this is going to be really important to understand, the Hamiltonian system. And it's not unique to Hamilton, but it's because Hamilton was putting it together as the treasurer of the United States once you created this United States. And of course, we've already done a lot of articles on what happened when they created the United States. The United States was literally an international corporation when it was created. A lot of people say, well, no, it was the government. Well, no, it was a corporate government. If you just read the Constitution and you read a corporate charter, it reads like a corporate charter. It's got officers. It's got ways of electing these officers. It's got oaths of office. It's got limitations and description of offices. And, of course, in creating the United States government, was very limited. And, of course, everybody thinks of the United States government as we the people. But then we can show you United States Supreme Court cases where the people were not a party to the Constitution in the beginning. So back there, you know, anybody who's thinking, you know, about ready to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States Constitution, but the people have not been a party to the Constitution for all 250 of those years. They didn't become a party to the Constitution until really, really after the Civil War. Up to that time, and after that, and especially getting into the First World War, and some of the things that were changing in the early 1900s, the people were not a party to the Constitution. They weren't citizens of the United States. They were citizens of the individual states. If anybody called you a citizen of the United States, chances are you were called that because you were an ambassador from the United States. And there, if you were an ambassador from the United States, you could get a passport saying that you were an ambassador of the United States, and people would refer to you as a United States citizen. But if you actually ask that ambassador, where was he a citizen of, or what was he a citizen of, a lot of, he might say he's from the United States, but he's a citizen of Virginia, or he's a citizen of North Carolina. That's just in the language. It is what they were doing. So the status of the people were changing based upon the evolution of the Constitution, adding amendments, adding institutions within the government that you could contract with. See, they can create an institution in the government. You can go and contract with that institution and thereby contract with the government. And of course, when you went down and got a Social Security number, you were entering into a contract, because there's terms. You go read the act, and there's terms for that. And there were a lot of other things that if a railroad belonged to the United States federal government, you went to get work for the railroad. Or if you went to work for the United States Forest Service as an employee of the United States Forest Service, now you have an employee-employer contract. You still may be a citizen of Virginia, but you have an additional relationship with the United States. Well, this grew and grew and grew over time, at the same time that the United States was setting the scene to change the nature of the economy in the United States, so that you could almost not have a Hamiltonian system of economy. And why is this all important? So Hamilton Economics somewhat was put together by Hamilton himself, although there were plenty of people writing about it in those days. And Trump, who is the president of the United States right now, is fashioning a lot of his economic policies based on what they called Hamiltonian economics. And that this vastly differs from what they use in Europe, and vastly different than what they use in England. They have more of a British imperial banking system and economics. Without going into all the detail of history, because I want to move this along so that we get a little bit of, so that we're actually going somewhere with this picture. Henry Kissinger was somebody who had a great deal of effect on American policy. He was the one that was part of the opening the doors so that we were going to try free markets with China, which, like I said at the very beginning, is impossible because the Chinese are not allowed to pursue their self-interest. It's kind of like, you know, everywhere, and I pointed this out before, capitalism is about individualism. It's the individual. Now, individuals can get together and they can create cooperatives, they can create partnerships, and they, to some degree or another, they can kind of become a collective. But the collective is in the operation of the business that they're creating, the market that they're establishing. But in a communist nation, the government is the collective. The kingdom of God is based on individualism. All the power is constantly being placed into the hands of the individual. He can relinquish some of that power, but usually only over a thing. He doesn't relinquish his power to choose. He only relinquishes, and generally speaking, there are exceptions to that. If a man gets married, he is now taken his power to choose to have a wife, and he has made the choice. And so now he can't make a choice, well, I want to have a different wife. Because if he actually stays to his vows, he has to stay with that wife till death do us part. And so there are situations where you can make a choice and you can't remake that choice or alter that choice. One of the ways you do this, besides getting married, which is a perfectly great way of giving up some of your choices, is you can go into debt. And if you go into debt, you may not have as many choices as you did before you went into the debt, because now you have an obligation. You've created an obligation. Now, you can create an obligation that says, where you promise to come and take care of somebody's chickens for the week while he's gone. Or you can, and we covered this just in our study on Leviticus, that you can, somebody wants to take a pilgrimage to the promised land, and he's going to go to the festival, and he's going to be gone for a month, and he says, I'm going to leave my sheep with you, and you take care of my sheep. You got sheep, we'll just mix them together. You take care of my sheep. You hold them in trust for me until I come back. Or you're going to go to war, and he's going to watch your place while you go to war. Now, we had this in Europe when they went on the Crusades, and other times when they went away to war, like go from England to France to fight battles for months and months and months on end. 100 years war, etc., you would leave your estate with your younger brother and then go off to fight the war, and then you may not come back for 4 or 5 years or 6 years or something. There are many cases where a guy came back and the brother says, oh, you're not my brother. You don't even look like my brother. And they throw him out. Of course, they've written old books about this. And so he had the property in trust, but he didn't restore it. And of course, that's why Leviticus 6 is saying you can't do that. But they had this idea of entrusting. So you can take on a responsibility, an obligation, and you have limited right to choose. And, or you can say to somebody, I'll rent you my place for 7 years. For 7 years, it's his place. You can't go and say, oh, I want it back. If you do that and go into debt, I'm going to rent you my place for 7 years, but you have to give me $10,000 now. And so he gives you the $10,000 and you go off and you gamble it away and you come back and you say, I want my place back. And he says, well, you don't get it back for another 6 years. Sorry. I got it now. You've limited your choices. So you can do that. Lots of different ways you can limit your choices. And of course, if you become that citizen of the government, we just went over that in the prodigal son story. He became a citizen. That's what it says in the Bible, in this other place. And it created obligations, and he had to work for a master. And he could only eat what the master gave him, and he was subject to the master. And he said, I'd be better off as a servant in my father's house, and he goes back. Well, this has been going on for 100 years in America. Of course, they have regular 4th of July events where they say that, yeah, we're the freest nation in the world, yet more and more of their wages now belong to the government. More and more of their rights are diminishing away. Many of the things they thought they had a right to do, they don't. I mean, in Germany, it's illegal to homeschool your children. They tried to make it illegal in parts of the United States. People resisted, and they're coming back, and more and more people are now training their children. I just heard in the last 24 hours about numerous schools in Oregon that are closing down because more and more parents are opting to do what they call distance learning, where they sign up. They're still being trained by public school, but they're being trained in their own houses. And so therefore they can watch the assignments of the teachers. This all came out of COVID when they started doing this, and the people found out what the schools were teaching their kids. I think it's great. It's a step in the right direction. But those changes are constantly being made. But eventually we want to understand what kingdom economics is so that we don't get carried away with these other things like Hamiltonian economics. Well, I know that one of the first things I see here is, and I'll jump around a little bit. I do it anyway. An ambassador, Greer, Jameson Greer, for the United States, gave a speech, I think in 2026 at Davos, between 2025 and 2026. And he championed Hamiltonian economics as a national interest approach, reviving tariffs, industrial policies, and a focus on domestic manufacturing to rebuild the United States middle class and to secure economic independence. Greer frames this as a defensive pragmatism to counteract non-market practices. Who and what is he talking about? And since I just read that, I want to make sure I don't go back and read it again. So, Alexander Hamilton assists what they call the Hamiltonian economics is a system of national mercantilism and government-assisted development designed to build a strong industrialized nation. Now, there has to be other factors in order for this to work, but that was the idea of mercantilism with some government assistance. It centers on the federal assumption of state debts, creating a national bank, protective tariffs, and government investment in infrastructure, and Hamilton advocated for the federal government to take on the state debt that had occurred during the American Revolutionary War and create a national credit and unite the states by that national credit system. I am not in favor of Hamiltonian economics. I am just making the observation that that is what some of these elements of Hamiltonian economics is what Trump is working on. And we know that because you can go and read his national reports, he's putting this forward constantly. I mean, that's bringing up tariffs. Now, I'll just give you a heads up. And he talks about protective tariffs specifically in Hamiltonian economics. Why do you need protective tariffs? Well, especially if you're going to be trying to do free markets with a communist nation. Because they can take money from all sorts of things and produce products for less than what it costs to produce those products, flood the market in the United States, drive everybody in the United States out of business who was trying to produce those products, and then corner the market. But that's not a free market. You're not the self-interest of the people in China is the self-interest of the communist government collective. And that puts you at a disadvantage. Unless, of course, you're going to impose tariffs and subsidize your workers like they subsidize the workers in China. Well, you won't be able to do that unless you have some sort of resource. Well, the United States has such a resource, they can increase taxes, like income tax, on the people, property taxes, sales taxes, fuel taxes, all the different kinds of taxes on the people, and that can fund that subsidization. But now you're stepping out of the realm of Hamiltonian economics, and you're also stepping out of the realm of capitalism, because you're taking more and more from the people. So there's a fundamental flaw, I don't know if anybody has caught it yet, but we'll eventually get around to it, that is with Hamiltonian economics that can be worded almost the same way in kingdom economics, but it will look completely different. Okay, so President Trump formally nominated former Governor Kevin Warsh to serve as the next chair in the Federal Reserve. That's what he's shooting for. And if he's confirmed by the Senate, he may have already been, he would replace Jerome Powell. And what he wants to do is put his man, I don't know if it'll work, put his man in the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve has been influenced by foreign powers, just the same as Trump mentioned, foreign powers are influencing the Supreme Court. Who are these foreign powers that are influencing the Supreme Court? Who are the foreign powers that are influencing the Federal Reserve? And, well, who has an economic system that is diametrically opposed to Hamiltonian economics? And, of course, it is British imperialism. And British, at one time, had vast, they built all kinds of stuff in England, mostly ships. They built a lot of ships. They built a lot of other things. They had coal. They had steel mills. They had all these kinds of things. But then as they started getting colonies, they started getting their colonies to build these things. And they have slowly shifted so that the only thing they produce that keeps the British crown afloat is primarily debt. It's British banking. They also make a lot of money through insurance, like Lloyd's of London, insuring people. That's very lucrative too. And they have another source of a great deal of income that most people don't even think about anymore. It was well known at the time of the American Revolution. It was certainly well known just historically during the Boxer Rebellion in China, is they were controlling the opium trade. I was excavating in Paisley, where we were going to build a new restaurant years ago. It has actually burned down since we built it. But when we were excavating to put in the foundation, I found just gobs of these little tiny bottles. And I couldn't figure out where they all come from. What were they used for? And just, it was just amazing. And I talked to an old timer. I collected them all, and he says, well, those are opium. That's what they used to deliver the opium. And I said, opium? Yeah, you could get your opium at the back door of the old restaurant, which was a house before we tore that down and built a new one. But and since then, I've done a lot of research on it. I mean, even Lewis and Clark coming across in their medicine kit, coming across the United States, they carried opium. Opium was everywhere. And who controlled the opium trade? It was the British. And they made lots and lots of money doing that. And they controlled whole areas because they controlled the opium markets. And the fact is that's still going on today, not just opium. Now we got fentanyl, we got all these other drugs that are going on, and they control that. In order to control that, make the billions of dollars that they, you know, this, you know, goes over to heroin and morphine and all these other name drugs, but they're basically along the same ground, methamphetamines, everything. But you don't think of the crown as the people behind that industry. But the reality is the cartels couldn't function without banks and banking institutions. So they have to have the cooperation of the crown. And so the crown has been working behind the scenes for years and years and years, manipulating governments. I mean, people complain about Israel now and the Zionists now, and they're blame everything on them now. Who created Israel? Who established Israel? Who established the head of Iran? Who established Iran as a government? Who established Kuwait as a government? Qatar as a government? Who was the guys that were instrumental in dividing all these countries up? You know, the one country they did not, they made promises to allow the Kurds to have a country, but they decided to divide the Kurds up between the Iraqis and the Iranians and the Turks because they were afraid if the Kurds had their own country, they'd be too difficult to control. You could control the Iranians, you could control, the Iraqis, because they had so many different religious groups and ethnic groups that you just have to keep them off balance, and they'll never come together and actually create a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And they've done all this behind the scenes economically. We see the fighting in Russia and the Ukraine now. They've had several different agreements early on and the battle between the Ukraine and Russia. Ceasefire, going to end this battle. We're going to go back and establish borders and everything. And they may not have had to give up any territory, but they would have had to create a demilitarized zone. They would have to, you know, agree not to become a part of NATO. There were a number of things. But they had an agreement. Who flew to the Ukraine and told them not to sign it and to tear it up? He'd actually already signed it. It wasn't completely official. But they tore it up. Great Britain went there and got them to tear it up. Why is that? Because their system only works if you keep the people divided. And they are also now moving into the idea that you want to create more of a socialist state and control the people. Because they know that a socialist state weakens the people, degenerates the people. Our quote from Polybius, 150 years before Christ, tells you that if you want to degenerate the people, you create a socialist state with benefits. And when the people develop a habit of receiving those benefits at the expense of others, they degenerate. And they will degenerate into perfect savages, finding once more a monarch and a king. That's how you get tyranny, is that you break down the social bonds of a society. And we see it even at the time of Christ, Plutarch saying, the greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. So the socialist state that's going to provide benefits at the expense of your neighbor is going to weaken your society, which will allow tyrants to rise to the top. And of course, the British imperial model requires somebody at the top, a king. They'll put maybe a prime minister in there and a parliament in there, but they'll control those guys too, through favors from behind the scenes. That's their economic model. That is not the economic model of Hamiltonian limited government. But the problem with a government that exercises authority, taking over the debt, supporting the industry, and Hamilton was even for individual welfare. You know, he wanted to interpret general welfare to include individual welfare. Probably not to the scale we see it today in America, but he was for this. All reasons why I would avoid Hamiltonian economics. But from where we're at right now, I don't know what Trump's long goal plan is, but we know that he is trying to implement Hamiltonian economics. And like I said, I was going to give you a heads up. Every major leader in America, including presidents, that tried to implement Hamiltonian economics has been assassinated. The whole history, go back, I can't name you all of them. I mean, that's what Lincoln was moving towards, is Hamiltonian economics and restoration after that war. Hamiltonian economics would undermine the imperial economics. And when I say the imperial crown, you know, Charles, he's actually a Moravian. He is the crown in England. He has a castle over there. As a matter of fact, supposedly, according to some people, he owns Dracula's castle, and he's had it refurbished. So he's involved with a lot of people all over Europe. But right now, the reason they're continuing the Ukraine war and delaying settling the Ukraine war, and I'm not saying that Russia doesn't have a lot of blame in this. There's a lot of reasons why Russia did this. I don't think they were wise. I think there would have been better things to do, but they were being goaded into this war by the actions of Europe. Because if they just did not bring in any of the NATO weapons in there, and they actually protected the people in the Donbas, Europe should have been saying, look, we know that National Socialists and Burisma and had private armies that were shelling into the Donbass within the Ukraine. They were shelling from the Ukraine into the Ukraine, killing Russian-speaking people that have lived in the Ukraine for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Russia said, stop it. And the United States knew they were doing that. CIA knew they were doing that. Anybody in politics knew that, you know, thousands of people had died from this shelling into there, usually with mortar fire, but you go a long ways with mortar fire. And this was the private army. We actually made movies about these private armies. I can't remember the name of the movie, but I saw it, but it was talking about this, where they were supposed to be demilitarized, and they had these private armies running around in the woods, killing Russians. Ukrainian Russians, because, I mean, even the president of Ukraine now, he used to only speak Russian. He had to learn Ukrainian in order to be the president, because he come from over there in the Donbass area where they speak Russian. So all this is going on, it's just a matter of, it's not a secret, but because people go to the media and they go on X and they go on Facebook and they see these clips and everything, they think they know what's going on, but they don't know any real history. You can look up these articles. I should have been saving the links to the actual documents that the government's been putting out, the actual studies. I heard somebody today quoting him, but he didn't quote the whole thing. And you think he's, oh, they're saying that there's no threat from Iran in this document that came out. Well, you didn't read the whole thing. You just clipped out little pieces of it. I went and read it. You're deceiving people by your presentation. Sounds legit. And people say, well, that's outrageous. Well, yeah, but he didn't read the whole thing. He only read what he wanted to read. And the guys who write it, they don't realize that people are going to do this. One thing I can tell you, in kingdom economics, you take back your responsibilities. You take back your individual interest in a capitalist economy. But if you don't also take back your responsibility that Moses mentioned, Christ mentioned, to love your neighbor as yourself, even the stranger in your midst, even your enemy, then you're not ready for kingdom economics. And so you've got to do more research to find out what the big picture is, what's really going on behind the scenes. One source is the Promethean Action Group I've mentioned. You look up Promethean. It's not a society, institute maybe. I don't know what their last name is, but a couple old ladies have been following this since the 70s. But they bring the receipts. And they're right about a lot of the things they say. They still don't, they're advocates of Hamiltonian economics. They're big advocates of Trump. I don't advocate or not advocate. I recognize he's the president of the United States government that is a legitimate government that does a lot of things that they shouldn't do that is not legitimate. And we can go into our history and see that. They give way too much power to the CIA. They certainly gave way too much power to all these NGOs and USAID and all these different groups, and they were actually funding things that were not in the best interest of the United States and or the citizens of the United States. And, of course, if you go read the Declaration of Independence, governments are instituted to protect the rights of the people. And if you're letting the CIA run amok, chances are they're not going to be respecting the rights of the people. If you don't respect the rights of the people in other countries and you're constantly trying to do regime change and undermine legitimate governments, even though they're just semi-legitimate governments, you're not allowing the choices of the people. And nobody should have ever let the CIA do a lot of the things that they were doing. Like I said, I have relatives that were in the CIA. They probably passed now, but they were still alive when my father was alive. But they were doing lots of things they shouldn't have been doing. But that's what you get when you centralize the power of your government. And, of course, if we go back to the Bible real quick, because we're an hour into this now, the Bible is the book for the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. And we need to understand that and how that works. And, of course, that's why we're going through our studies on Leviticus and Genesis and the Gospels, etc., were showing you that Jesus was actually preaching a form of government where you take back your responsibilities for yourself and for your neighbor. I know a lot of anarchists who don't want any government benefits and they want to take back the responsibility for themselves, and they want to, you know, produce their own money and keep their own money, and they don't want to pay taxes and they want to avoid taxes. Sometimes they do it illegally and they shouldn't do that, but a lot of times they're just, maybe they're legally trying to avoid taxes, and they figured, you know, like some of them moving down to areas of South America. I don't know if they go to where they, what countries they go to, Nicaragua or different countries. I know some that went to Nicaragua. Probably some are in El Salvador now. Who knows? And they're trying to avoid taxes. I know some went to St. Croix Island and got citizenship in St. Croix. You could get citizenship in St. Croix Island, which is a republic. It's still in the British Commonwealth. But all you had to do is invest $40,000 in construction, and they would give you a St. Croix passport, and you could denounce your U.S. citizen. You could go anywhere in the world with your St. Croix passport, and it only costs you $40,000 of investment in a building you would still own. So it's not really any money out of your pocket. But, and I know guys who did that, and they did it to avoid taxes. And yeah, okay. And they wanted to take responsibility for, and they had the money to do it. But that's not kingdom. Kingdom economics is that you want capitalism, but you have a system of social welfare, because capitalism by itself has no system of social welfare. Socialism often does. It usually becomes corrupted and ineffectual, and you end up, you know, like finding out you need an operation in Canada, and you've got single payer, and you know Canadian government will pay for it. Unfortunately, they won't start paying for it until after you're dead. Because the waiting line is so long. So, yeah, socialism has those systems, but they're often not as effective as free market capitalism, if you could find that anywhere. But the reality is, in Israel, there was a system, a social safety net. It was an extremely well-funded social safety net that protected people from abject poverty. It protected them if they did not have the actual ability to compete in the market. They didn't have to live on the street and beg from house to house and set up tents. They could actually be put in tiny houses. They would be given chores, because we have the, well, of course this is New Testament, but they have similar, deals in the Old Testament. I mean, the whole idea of the Sabbath is you work 6 days. Now, if you were incompetent and you worked for those 6 days and we looked at what you produced in those 6 days, it might not be enough to feed you, but if you work that, we will feed you. This is what gleaning in the field is all about. We will make sure you don't starve to death, because we love our neighbor, we love our poor, we love the stranger in our midst, but we know that you gotta work. It's in the commandments. God worked for 6 days and then he took his day of rest. You can't go on welfare and rest for 6 days and expect us to come and pick up the bill on the seventh day. You'll end up being fat and lazy and probably eating all the wrong things. The reality is, this is what the social safety net of the kingdom of God was under Moses. It was the same thing that Jacob was doing when he became Israel. It was the same thing that Abraham was doing and Isaac were doing. They had a system of social welfare funded by altars, where people put a sacrifice on the altar, and other people that you, and the altars were altars of living stone, you would give it to men that you thought would do a good job and redistribution of that offering. There's a guy up in Portland. He worked for the federal government because he wanted to go into social work. He does a video almost every day and puts it on Facebook. My wife follows him. I think I look at a lot of his videos, but he walks down the streets of Portland. He originally, when he worked for the government, he was sent out to give out clean needles to drug addicts. And they have a whole kit where you have the band and the needles and the syringe and all this stuff. And they actually will now include a Narcan kit with it. So if you overdose, you can take the Narcan. You'll have it right with you to keep you alive, I guess, so you can buy drugs the next day too. Well, he was giving it to a husband and wife who were living under a bridge. But how were they getting the drugs? They were pimping out their 13-year-old daughter. And when he realized it, he was complaining, and the workers said, we're not to get involved, we're not to turn them in, we have to build their trust, and that's why we're giving out the needles. And he says, I was a part of the problem. And he always regrets that he didn't go and turn those people in and get that girl off the street. He has no idea where she is today, but he's dedicated his life to actually helping people. The government you have created for yourself is not helping people with their social welfare. They're weakening them. Now, the imperial system wants the people weak. And a lot of the spirit of the imperial system, you could call it the tyrannical system. You could call it a lot of things. But it's a system where somebody's at the top and everybody else is underneath that. We could call it the Babylonian system. Nimrod at the top. He appoints men from the top down. And that's his system. The kingdom of God is the reverse. You take all the power that Nimrod has ended up with, and you take it back, and you put it in the hands of the people. Basically, let's go back to the Hamiltonian economics. I came across one of the titles, the National Security Strategy, that's published every year. We publish that. I went through and read it for several years back. I've read the commentaries on it. The UK produces a similar, national security strategy, and you can hold the two up side by side. And you'll find that Trump is saying, because basically it's coming out of the Trump, presidency. He talks about ending the perception and preventing the reality of NATO as a perpetually expanding alliance. He wants to go away from that. Of course, Jefferson would be against that. Because that would be getting involved too much in foreign wars. And they disused America as a police force. He says, encouraging Europe to take action to combat mercantilist overcapacity, technological theft, cyber espionage, other hostile economic practices. Some of these cyber espionage and technological theft destroys small businesses, big corporations. We see it. There was a movie. I can't remember the actor. Sorry. Just can't remember the names of the guys. He's a great actor. Done a lot of good jobs. But he invented a way to make windshield wipers reciprocate. And his name isn't important to the deal. But he invented this, and then he was going to sell it to the big companies, and that they thought, well, we got engineers, we don't need him. But then he finally showed, but he kept it secret and everything, and then he had to produce it, and they gave him big long contracts. Basically, they cheated him out of his invention. And he didn't have the money to fight. It was cheaper to hire lawyers to just blockade him so he never gets. He lost his job. He lost his family. He fought for years and years and years. Eventually, he won in court, and he got a big settlement, but he'd lost everything, his whole life. It just became an obsession because he was so outraged that this major corporation robbed him of his invention, that why not share it with him? Well, it's because, I don't remember if it was Ford, but it could have been Ford, Chevy, whatever, General Motors. Christ was not in them. Why are these big corporations so successful and Christ is not in those corporations? Well, it's because the United States and the people of the United States made choices way back that started moving us farther and farther away from kingdom economics. And one of the things that we did is we accepted the idea of the Federal Reserve. Madison warned about this. Jefferson warned about it. Jackson fought against it, president after president, and a lot of the American people fought against it, the idea of having this national bank, although Hamilton is suggesting that we have that national bank. To what degree and what form, it's difficult to tell looking back, but he was edging us that way because he wanted the federal government to take over state debt. And this would unite the states. Absolutely, it would unite the states. But what he didn't realize is it would weaken the people. And I'll give you an example, because this is ingrained in you, you'll start to see with different eyes everything. Every political move, whether it's on the right or the left, Republican or Democrat, whatever, you'll start to see all the interactions of governments with a different viewpoint. Once you begin to understand the kingdom economics. And how would we summarize the kingdom economics? I haven't put it down into simple words yet. One quote just keeps popping into my mind. and I think the Holy Spirit is pushing it onto me. So I will repeat it here. That the kingdom economics is about love. And love is about sacrifice. And sacrifice is, to one degree or another, you laying down your life for the welfare of others. Now, this is built into nature. Like I mentioned on the show that I've got a new niece that was born the other day. It was a very rough birth, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And almost every reason for that is choices that people made years ago, and it's made it worse and worse and worse, but they made it, and the child is born, and it's alive, and it's doing well, and that's good. They survived a lot of their mistakes, but that child is, you know, they were talking about, you know, taking the child. The woman went full term, well, pretty well full term. It was still, I think, a little premature, but it's doing well. And she was willing to take the risk and take the sacrifice. And now, of course, you know, whenever I had a kid, I had a child once, it was born in one of our, but anyway, I was holding the child. I mean, I was there at the birth, and we did have it in the hospital. There were some complications. We went to the hospital, but I stayed with him, and I had the child, and they tried to take the child from me. Now, my wife's already in the room, and I'm holding the child, and I said, well, no, I've got it. And I said, well, no, we have to take it. And I says, no, you don't have to take it. The child's doing fine. It's sleeping. And I walked down the hallway and was walking back because the child rested better when I was walking, and my wife was going to sleep. It was 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they blocked the aisle. Two really big nurses and a male nurse, they're blocking the aisle, and I says, what's up? You know, I stopped, and they says, you're going to have to give us that baby. And I said, no, I don't. And I just smiled back at them, and they says, if you don't give us that baby, you're going to have to take responsibility for that baby. And I said, I took responsibility for this baby 9 months ago. And I just looked at them, and it was like, again, the parting of the Red Sea. It wasn't as big as that mob that I faced in San Francisco, but it was still like the parting of the Red Sea. Two on one side, one on the other, but a pretty big one on the one side. And I just walked through, went back to the room, and nobody got that baby. But the fact is that's what we have to do, is start taking not only responsibility for ourselves, like a lot of these anarchists who say, I take care of myself, I don't need the government. Great. Can you take care of anybody else? Well, I don't care about anybody else. I just want to take care of myself. Well, when we went through our study on Ecclesiastes, that if you just do everything for only your self-interest, which we covered there, capitalism, free market economy, only for your self-interest, then, you missed it. That's not kingdom economics. You have to take it for the interest of others. Now, it's a lot easier when it's your child and your child is cute and sweet and you're a father and you like, this is my kid, like the one comedian says, when I first held my son, I said, I would die for this guy, and I don't even know him yet. It's my son, and he could be a jerk, but I would die for this kid, because he's holding his first child. And he says, but when they gave me my daughter, when my daughter was born, second child was the daughter, he said, I would kill for this girl. Because he's a comedian, he's making kind of a joke out of it. But that I know the feeling that waking up something in a man and in a woman, they go through this difficult sacrifice of having the child, and it becomes a precious thing to them. Of course, we can go into, our article on milk and meat. You don't want to boil that child in the mother's milk. You need the husband there to also strengthen the child and put restrictions on the child. Well, you have to do the same thing with the poor in your community. Because that same love you have for your own children, which you need to work on and get it right, otherwise your child might grow up being addicted to drugs or addicted to porn or addicted to politics or, some terribly detrimental thing. Addicted to lies. They would rather hear lies if it conforms to their ideology. And the fact is, if you're seeking the kingdom of God, you're seeking the truth about everything, and you want to let everybody have their right to choose, and you want to be out of the debate, but seeking the truth. Somebody wrote something about, I can't remember what they wrote. I kind of remember what I wrote, is that debate is not the same thing as reasoning. You can debate, misinformation. I said you can't reason with misinformation, the person said. You can debate misinformation, but you can only reason with reasonable people. But if you're a debater, if you're about winning the argument rather than finding the truth, then you're not going to be reasoning. You're going to be debating. When it becomes important to you that other people accept your idea, if your love for other people depends upon their acceptance of your ideology, you're going to find reasoning very difficult. Ultimately, I think it's just amazing when I finally discovered it. I should have discovered it way back when I was learning Greek from Father Dirks back in 1962 and 63. He was an amazing teacher. But it just never came across my studies at the time. But the word, Jesus was the word. The word there is logos. That is the word for reasoning. We don't want you to have blind faith, but we want you to have the reasoning of Christ, the understanding of Christ. And when we're looking out at all the activities in the world today, what we got the other side. We got Trump over there doing his thing. And you got the, you know, most of the people that are probably supporting Trump don't really understand why they're supporting Trump. And some of them are supporting Trump for the wrong reason. But I can also guarantee you that most of the people that hate Trump, they don't even know why they hate Trump. Oh, they'll say, oh, he's a racist, or he's this and that, or he's so crude, or whatever. We've had a lot of presidents who are crude. They just weren't crude in the open. They were crude behind closed doors. And some of them have gotten caught. But the reality is that it's a show. Politics is a show. But real lives are at stake. But the kingdom of heaven isn't about politics. It's about people. It's about inalienable rights. In order to have those inalienable rights, people have to take back their inalienable responsibilities. And there is a spiritual battle afoot. And most of the people are unaware of where the spirit comes in, because they can't really define, because they're not filled with the Holy Spirit, they can't really define that where God is in a situation. When God was going to deliver the people out of the bondage of Egypt, he actually had Moses saying things to the Pharaoh. It was a very particular Pharaoh. It was Thutmose III. He had very particular things that he was saying to him to make him angry. And they had found his mummy. They believe they found his mummy. Based on the evidence I've seen, it's likely it is his mummy, and it has what appears to be his son laying next to him. They're buried together. They're not in a sarcophagus. That's all been stolen, but the mummies were left behind. But the son is covered with boils and probably died during that final plague, which we're not going to go into here. But the reality is that it was making the Pharaoh make choices that were detrimental to the Israelites that made them stronger. His hand was in that. People died because of what God was putting in the mouth of Moses. Because people rebelled against the words of Moses and did things that were bad. There is, you know, people, am I saying that people deserve to die? Did that, you know, I'm the same guy that months and months ago, last White Rock Festival that we had out here, which was last, whenever that is, April, May, I said it to people, it was a realization, nobody dies. Nothing dies. Everything changes. I don't know why I didn't realize that earlier. I kind of did, but I didn't have the vocabulary to say it. I when I say that now, I have a mental photograph of my Boy Scout handbook for a nature badge, which was I was reading when I was 11 years old, a couple years before I went into the seminary. And in it, it showed this cycle of life. That cycle of life is real for all creatures, great and small. And so nothing dies, everything changes. And yet, we suffer death, but everything lives. Now, there is a fire that consumes, but most people don't know what that is. We're getting off the topic. But the reality is that things are playing out now. But we need to be working towards moving towards kingdom economics. Now, theoretically, I don't know what's going to happen. There's so many things up in the air with what's going on in Iran. A lot of the reports that we're getting, it's just amazing. The American press is doing the same thing they've done for years. You know, I didn't vote for Trump. And I said that he's not our salvation from the beginning. I said if he gets elected, he's going to shake things up. He's certainly shaking things up. He's making lots of choices I myself would not make, but I'm not in those positions. I'm not justifying anything that he's doing, but I know there is a God behind everything. Does that mean that God wants all those people bombed? I can tell you this, if God wanted to stop it, he would stop it. I can tell you this, there will be people that don't go to a particular place that is destroyed. I've seen this in my life. And people, I ask them, why didn't you go there? Why didn't you get on that plane? Why didn't you get in that car with those guys? And they say, I don't know. It's the same way with the shot. I ask people who never, they take all the vaccines, but they wouldn't take the COVID vax. I said, why didn't you take it? I don't know. I just couldn't do it. And about a lot of things. And of course, I've lived my life that way a lot of times. And I recently mentioned the story where I had a choice laid out before me when I was 19 years old. And I could go this way or I could go that way. And somebody would pay my way to go this way and fund it and everything. And I would avoid what looked like was going to be a very difficult and trying thing where I was going to actually maybe end up in Vietnam killing gooks, which I didn't want to do. I was willing to go into the service, and I had lots of options, and I'd already sat there and said, I can't do this, and I wouldn't do it. Something stopped me from, I could have gone into Annapolis. Later on, I could have gone into West Point. But I couldn't sign the paper. My arm wouldn't work. Something was holding me back, was blocking me from doing that. I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand how it worked then. But it wouldn't let me do that. But it said that I could go this particular route, and I went that route, thinking like, this is not what I should do, just like Jacob. But it turned out, and in order for it to turn out, all the details we don't have time to go into, I'll save it for the White Rock Festival if somebody comes and listens to it, or maybe some other time, some other call. But the reality is people thousands of miles away met and made choices and did things and changed laws and everything so it worked out in my favor. I couldn't do any of that. And that same power is working in Iran, it's working in Washington, D.C., it's working in Portland, it's working all over the place. And everybody has the choice to become a conduit to that power. But they won't make the right choice if they're trying to fix it with their own willfulness. Because that is one of the first things that you must sacrifice. And Christ said it in his prayer. Yeah, when you have a baby, you're going to sacrifice sleep. You're going to sacrifice time. You're going to maybe pay the hospital bills. You're going to have to change the diaper. All that requires sacrifice. But one of the most important sacrifices that you have to make is to say the prayer of Christ. Not my will, but thine. And trust that there is a God, and God has his hand in it. And you just want to know what the absolute truth is. And so what's going on behind the scenes, and I'm not saying it's going to work, I'm just saying that this is the strategy floating around in people's minds, is that Trump is trying to implement this Hamiltonian economics. And in order to do that, he had to attack the drug cartels for numerous reasons. One is they're delivering drugs all over the world, and certainly in the United States, it's killing all kinds of people and poisoning society. Of course, the best way to stop that is that everybody repent and go back and seek the kingdom of God, and then your life won't seem so purposeless that you go and get on the drugs to begin with. Ultimately, that's what's going to save people from the drugs. Blowing up those boats is not going to do it. But blowing up those boats is going to curtail the funding of their cartels. How are their cartels moving that money around to do the things that they do? They need the cooperation of British banking. And they were doing it through Venezuela, and they were doing it through those little countries that nobody can name that's right next to Venezuela, but they needed to pass through Venezuela. And so he stopped that. And also, he took control of the oil. He doesn't need the oil. But he also took control of the Panama Canal. He doesn't need the control of the Panama Canal, but he will. And he's pushing the Chinese out. And what he's doing is bring, he's, I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying that this is what he's thinking. He's putting into effect this, the Monroe Doctrine. He's focusing on the Americas from South America to the tip of Canada and including Greenland in that. And he's trying to make this a bloc and make it a bloc outside of the reins of socialism. Now, what, and I keep saying British banking, but we can just say, you know, the Babylon banking system that only loans debt. It doesn't fund industry. It loans debt. It buys up things. It established, we don't have time to go into it, but the whole idea of Federal Reserve notes means you can't buy land, you can't buy factories, because you can't pay a debt with a note. So they're into creating debt. This is how Nimrod rose to power. This is what you see when you see them creating these idols, and we talked about it briefly, and we'll actually come up to some chapters in Leviticus where what they're doing is setting up small, isolated banking systems. The golden calf was setting up a banking system. Aaron knew the arts of the temple. The temple was a bank. It had depositories of gold in one treasury and grain in another. Well, they were still mobile, so they weren't storing up grain, but they could actually store it up so that you got to manage your sheep, but you didn't own them. You know, that's why, you know, they do inventory of all the sheep and the cattle in the United States. And they go out there and they count them. That's the same people that do the census when they count the people. They're counting their sheep. They're counting their cows. They're counting their livestock. Because it doesn't really belong to you, to the cattleman. He thinks it does, but it doesn't. But if the cattlemen were to repent and go back and seek the kingdom, it could again. And that gets into the complexities of kingdom economics. But in order to understand that economics, you have to start gathering together with the purpose to start the daily sacrifice, to sacrifice for the welfare of others, not merely for yourself. You have to start that casting your bread. You don't have to kill a red heifer and burn it up and take the ashes and go put them in a clean place. It doesn't have anything to do with that. But it has to do, and what people are trying to do, all the media, throwing out these ideas and giving half stories and stuff like that. See, you know, and I'm not justifying, you know, the bombing and all that kind of stuff. I'm just saying that these things are taking place, and they're taking place for a reason. And we can get into the fine details and discussion as to what's going on. But when you realize that God's in control and you're always asking God, not my will, but thine will, your next question has to be, what is thy will? Not what the leftists want you to do or the mega guys want you to do or whatever, but what God wants you to specifically do, you, yourself, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing. Are you advancing the kingdom or are you just straining at, you know, the gnats and the people who think they're in control? There's a lady, Mary Jane Steffen, who's an American political scientist, who's out there. She's the one that's trying to get all these protesters to use whistles and everything. And now, supposedly, she's not CIA trained, but if you read her book, Why Civil Resistance Works, it is a CIA handbook on regime change. And she is really, I don't know if she's the mastermind. You never know who the mastermind is. And I'm going to leave people with, this is one of my last comments. I'll look around. And there was a movie I saw way back when I was a little kid. I guess I was a little kid. I was pretty young. It was called What I Did on My Summer Vacations. And I actually can remember one of the actors was Robert Wagner. But basically, he was in love with the daughter of somebody who was high up in the behind the scenes politics of Europe. And basically, if you watch the movie, it almost disappeared after it came out. It's one of those movies like they don't want you to see this again. You can probably find a copy of it somewhere. I think it was what I did on my summer vacation. Odd name for a movie. But basically, if you know who's pulling the strings, they're not doing it right. Because you don't know who's really behind. I mean, like, who started? Who paid for a lot of people to go to Israel to start the Zionist movement in Israel? Iran. I was shocked, you know, back when, not Iran, let's go to Iraq. Well, they were planning to invade Iraq long before anybody mentioned weapons of mass destruction. They had lots of reasons to go in there. They literally sold side drilling oil equipment so that they could do those wells where they drill off so they can go underneath other people's borders. And they were doing this in Kuwait to go into the oil fields of Iraq and steal Iraqi oil. And Iraq was saying, why are you doing that? They couldn't sell it without the approval of the Secretary of State. And Iraq took it to the United Nations. They took it to the United States with their ambassador and says, if you sell this stuff to them, they're going to drill into our oil fields. They said, we don't care. They were goading Iraq into doing something like invade Kuwait so they would have an excuse to invade Iraq. Why did they want to invade Iraq? I haven't heard almost anybody in the news tell you why they were trying to invade Iraq. They got lots of excuses, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, Britain had some things they had sold Iraq illegally and they wanted to make sure nobody found those. So they got in on the invasion and they went and blew up the depots where those things that they had sold Iraq. So there's always these multiple. But what was the real motivation? I actually know somebody who I personally know. His father, I hired him many times to work for me. His father was a plumber. And he was taught Arabic. He looked Arabic. He was actually Italian. And I've seen photos. He showed me photographs of him in Iraq in the Arab outfit. He said he was within pistol range of Saddam Hussein many times. But he was not to kill Saddam Hussein. But he was setting up for the invasion long before the invasion. And because this was a plan. The real reason for the plan, I've never seen anybody publish it. I kind of saw somebody hinting at it, but he didn't really know. He just suspected. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes. If you think you know, you've probably swallowed somebody's lie. But even the presidents of the United States, I mean, they just uncovered a bunch of files, or at least they say they just uncovered it. But the FBI has been, since J. Edgar Hoover, has been keeping files hidden from every president. And they're not allowed to see them. And now they're uncovering them and they're going to be releasing them. And I don't have any idea what's in them, but I'll lay you odds, there are files behind those files that you don't get to see. There's all kinds of things. But the more you actually seek God, and I would seek it through doing small services for people, even people you don't even know. Every time you see these people, I don't know how many times I see people that in the news, I see them in, when they gather on these calls, I look at the names, the list of the names, I think of their family, I say a prayer for them. I extend out whatever spirit is in me out in their direction with love and not with criticism, not pointing out the fact that, oh, you don't see it. The fact is we all don't see something. But the God that created us, the God that gives us access to Him through the divine spark, through the tree of life, through the comforter, He sees it all. His hand is at it. And this is one of the first things Christ says. Pharaoh doesn't fall. Is that saying that, well, it's okay to bomb Iran? Well, I can tell you this. In the long run, well, I don't know how many, everybody's going to die. But tens of thousands of people have disappeared. I know people from Iran who escaped from Iran and suffered in Iran and had relatives suffered and relatives that disappeared, got arrested for suspicion and that were never seen again. We know there are mass graves. But I can tell you this, the Persians, the people of Iran are not going to be able to form a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, unless they start realizing what the Bible was really all about, what Abraham was really all about, what Moses was really all about, and start coming together that way. We already see there are factions that want to bring in the Shah's son. Doesn't seem like half bad guy, but you give him that kind of power, who knows where it's going to go. The original Khomeini, the Ayatollah, whatever you want to call him, he was preaching every week, and his preaching, his sermons were all recorded by guess who? The BBC. And guess who smuggled them into Iran, into the schools, to get the students to start to foment a revolution? It's the British were doing that. We know it was the British doing it. It was cassette tapes in those days. they're cassette tapes. And they got them all worked up. And some of those young rebels escaped back in 88 when they went through and they just started killing them all. They already consolidated their power and now they had to get rid of all the rebels. They didn't need that dissension anymore. China did the same thing. Soviet Union did the same thing. They use the young people. They get them all worked up. They get them worked up about justice and social justice. And what's happened is that the general, if you go and read the Quran, you know, I haven't read it in Arabic. I don't know Arabic. I thought about trying to learn some Arabic, but God says, no, you don't need to. There are plenty of guys that know it better than me. But, The reality is that it is very, that the very, it, nothing's very clear. It's very scattered. This is one of the big complaints all the way back in the 1400s is that it's not a very uniform book. And despite what a lot of people think, Old Testament, New Testament are very uniform books. They're saying the same thing from the beginning to the end. Although our interpretation, the pharisaical interpretation of the Old Testament as we're going through in Leviticus is not the same thing. It's very confused. But the Quran is all over the place. But if you, generally speaking, it's going to lead you to an ideology that is extremely useful to the same spirit that produced Marxism. They're not going to call it Marxism. They're going to call it a caliphate. But it's going to end up being the same thing. You're going to have vast numbers of weak people. And amongst those weak people, you're going to have an absolutely ruthless guard that you can sick on anybody who tries to raise up and terrorize them. But most of the people are going to have to be placid and peaceful. You know, 80% of the people in communism have to just go along to get along. They go to work, they do their job, they go back home. It's actually the Muslim rituals and ceremonies play into that. That's why you have guys, all you have to do is go out and bow down 6 times a day through kind of a mindless ritual and think good thoughts and peaceful thoughts and everything. And then we have a list of things. These are things we suggest you do These are things that you ought to do, and these are things that you have to do. And the people that will blindly do whatever you tell them, they are going to get the guns, and everybody else is going to be mostly peaceful. But they will never do anything when the guys who have the guns are raping and murdering and killing. Because they've been trained to be mostly peaceful. But they will go to work, and they will do the job. It's not unlike what the Spartans did. They had a vast number of people that plowed the fields, made the armor, did all the work of society. But it was the Spartans who were the battle people, and they were raised early. They were the fierce warriors. And so that's a system. That's the way hell is organized as well. Everybody's not fighting in hell, but it is a collective, and everybody has their specialized tasks. You are the peaceful people. You are the warriors. But what a lot of people don't realize is in order to do that, they lay out certain tests for these people to create that even the perfect savages, the violent ones, the ones who will literally go and blow up themselves and kill other people, they're really in the minority, but it doesn't take very many to wreak havoc and fear. Because it operates on fear. Communism operates on fear. National Socialism, the Nazis were operating on fear, and so does the caliphates. They all operate on fear. Christ does not. Christ operates on love. And this is one of the things, if you want to oppress the people, first you oppress the women. And of course we see that with a vast amount of the interpretations of the Quran, as you get to oppress the women. And then you go out and kill all the Jews, I can't even remember the name of the town where he first killed all the Jews. And he killed the other people too. It wasn't just the Jews, but, and then it was somebody else who really consolidated the teachings of, Muhammad, and then saw that this was instrumental so that I could become the tyrant and the caliphate. And so they started organizing their society that way. So you had the mostly peaceful people, farming the fields and picking the dates or whatever it is, and then you had this ruthless army that you could direct, and it would get extremely violent, and they would charge in to their death, because they know if I die doing this, I'm still going to, they're completely brainwashed, and they're zombies, and they take over. And because they have this other peaceful element, they can go out and, rewrite Plato. And Plato ends up, the writings of Plato made it into Europe to Muslims. Mathematics. The mostly peaceful people, some of them, because you had this consolidation of wealth, and this is what we're going to finally get to, this consolidation of wealth so that the caliphate could fund people who were doing mathematics and, examining the stars and learning the sciences and studying the ancient writings and duplicating them, created a lot of things in Arabic, and then shipped them into Europe. And a lot of the great thinkers survived because of the works of the Arabs. And I say, well, see, this is great. Yeah, and that is great. If it wasn't for all those other people they killed in the tens of thousands of slaves that were either castrated or raped, because the women were prized and they were doing all this stuff. And there's no question about whether or not it was done. And it was done because it was a collective. It wasn't kingdom economics. It was Babylonian economics in the form of caliphates. And then later on we had it, like I said, in the Soviet Union, in the form of Marxism. And then they tried it in China in the form of Marxism. They've tried it in several other countries in the same way. And of course, communism is just socialism on steroids. And Hamiltonian economics doesn't get us back to the kingdom. And I'll tell you, this is the last story, because we only got a minute, technically, to our two-hour mark. But when I was a young man, and first went out to North Dakota to work on my uncle's North Dakota wheat farm, and I've told this story, there were all these bibs of grain all over the farm. And my other uncles and other relatives had them on their farm. Some would have 9 in a row, 13 in a row, and they held tons and tons of grain. And they would sell that grain to the federal government. This is Hamiltonian economics. So the government would pay them for the grain at some sort of steady market rate. They could buy it back from the government at any time with just a tiny little bit of interest charged for that loan. But it kept the farms afloat so they could pay their bills when the market was getting flooded with grain. Because the market gets flooded with grain, the grain prices drop. Because people say, oh, I can't buy anymore. I don't have any more bins to put them in. So I can't even bid on it. I don't have a barge to put it in. So the grain prices would drop and everybody would kind of lose out if you didn't get your grain sold. But this is a way where I don't have to sell it in the years of surplus. I can put it up on my farm in certain size bins. And then if the crop fails, then I can buy it back from the federal government. And when my crop fails, everybody else's crop's probably failing, at least in our area. And so the price of grain is up. So I can buy it back and sell it at more than I bought it back from. And the government won't charge me market, right? It'll just charge me what they paid to buy it the first time. You know, I have to pay them that. And then I pay a little bit of interest. And so the farmers stay healthy. Because up in North Dakota, you could lose 2 crops out of 5. And that means no income. I've seen fields just mowed down by hail. And of course we had the grasshoppers go through back in the Depression. I wasn't there, but my grandmother tells about it. And this is a way to keep a steady supply of grain. Hamiltonian economics was to prepare for bad times. That's Joseph economics. Joseph said, I can see a famine coming. And so what we need to do is put up grain. Buy grain from everybody, because we're going to have 7 years of bumper crops, and we're going to have to put up that grain, and then we're going to have to store it with the intention of selling it back to people. And, of course, this is what brought Israel into the bondage. But they knew that 400 years they would be set free, and hopefully they would learn a lesson. We got some lessons to learn, and some bad times are coming, and it might result from whatever Trump is doing, but it'll be a part of God's plan, and that's the side of the equation you want to be on. But in kingdom economics, and if you had a network of tens, hundreds, and thousands, you don't need to build a wall down along the Mexican border. All your welfare is created through faith, hope, and charity. All the people that are in your network are laying down their life daily for their children and for your children. If they don't have children, they're going to help their next door neighbor raise their children, at least the next person in their congregation raise their children, because they're a collective of love. Not a collective of covenants or contracts or constitutions. And this changes you. The same as covetous practices change you. Charitable practices change you too. They draw you near the Holy Spirit, which will give you insight. So you'll finally know why they went into Iraq, which is one of the best kept secrets. And it hasn't really done them any good, even though they've gone through great efforts to, I mean, there was numerous reasons, but some of the big reasons, one of the reasons is they want to keep, I mean, at the time, we had Iraq and Iran fighting each other for years and years and years and years. I mean, it was just bloody. Children were being murdered. They would send children out to the minefields and they were blowing their legs off. I remember that. That was a real thing. And they were just fighting each other. But guess who was supplying the weaponry? If we want to find sins in American history or in Putin's history or China's history, we can find sins in all of their histories. We can't focus on the past sins. We recognize they're there. But what brings about that sin? Darkness. What brings about the light? Sacrifice. Every candle sacrifices itself so that it burns brightly today. And so that's the life we have to live. We have to be glowing that love out to everybody. We're not trying to prove ourselves right. People can take this or leave it. But kingdom economics, no, you never lose anything. Yeah, and nothing is lost. It's either goes to the service of God or it goes to the service of the gods of the world. And if it goes to the service of God, and it's very interesting that in most countries, if you give to the service of God, you got to find a church that's actually serving God. That's a trick. But if you find one and you give to that church, it's deductible. So, and it's kind of like evil rubbing your nose in your sin. That, you know, that everybody's complaining about what the government is taking all the time, but you could choose who you give it to. You could give it to the government, or you can't give everything to the government. I mean, I think there's limits in different countries. Some will limit it to 20% to a charitable institution, and some will limited to 50%. Most corporations are limited to 50%, although you can organize a corporation where it would be more. Hopefully it's not an NGO. But the reality is, this is the more you, and I really recommend that people meditate and just shut up your own mind for a while and wait upon the Lord and let God reveal to you what's really going on. I could have said a lot more about a lot of other things, but they all require more and more explanation. But believe this, there is a God. Just don't be a sluggard. By nature, they do not know the venomous nature of their own ideology, for they love their life more than they love the life of their neighbor. In kingdom economics, you have to love your neighbor's life equal to your own. And if the people of Persia began to realize that, somebody was telling me about, you know, people, well, we can walk down the streets and nobody molests us. This is the way it is up in Portland. That same place I was telling you about. You could go up to Portland. I could take you down street after street. Beautiful. Streets are clean. The houses are clean. There's no tents on the street. There's no drug addicts on the street. And you can go through block after block after block. And all the people who live in those areas, Portland's okay. There's no problem. They never go to the areas where the druggies are dying on the street. They have somebody else who goes up and picks up the bodies in the river. Every day. Every day this is happening. If you call up and you find a dead body on this, in certain parts of Portland, you find a body on the street, you call up, they might get there and pick it up before dark. They might have to wait and pick it up tomorrow. Chances are it's not going anywhere. Because he's dead already. But they'll be laying there dead of an overdose, and you'll see in their coat the bag of Narcan given to them by the government so that they can take the Narcan. And this goes on all the time. And the pimping and the trafficking of young girls, it's all hidden away. I mean, if you could hide away thousands of Somali daycares and autistic children and take away billions and billions of dollars. You think they can't hide a few girls they traffic? It's done all the time. All the time. And why? Because Americans have forgotten to care about their neighbor as much as they care about themselves and their own comfort and their own ideology. And we have to repent of that. And most will not. But those who do need to start to come together and start establishing the kingdom economics. Because we need to take on the debt of others and not simply try to escape our own debt. And with that, God will bless us. But you have to live this life of sacrifice. Jesus was rich and made himself poor. He gave up his wealth. And he talks about this. But you need people who don't want the wealth of others except to share it in a way that strengthens the poor. If you think of questions, you can send them to me. Maybe we'll cover them at another time. But things are afoot. And there's a spirit over here and there's a spirit over there. And they may be fighting it out. And we can talk about the ins and outs of all that. And if Trump called me, I could give him a lot of advice about what I think he needs to do. But you know what I'd eventually leave him with? You need to, he's a guy who can't sleep. He needs to be still. He's easily deceived by the right spirit. And every time you see somebody deceived, and this goes for every one of us as well, our weakness, the things that we don't want to see about ourselves, is an opening to evil that will get into us. And then we will willfully accept things or try things or follow paths, some of which there may not be coming back from in this life. So really everybody needs to get earnest about being still and finding out what God wants you to do. And focus on that. Because we can't save all of Egypt and the whole world. We cannot save all of Babylon. It's going to play out. It's Babylonic spirits that it's entertaining. We have to be that candle that burns. So that if you come into the presence of other people, they suddenly start to see things they didn't see before. I mean, it's literally that, it's that literal. And you don't see where their insight is coming from. But don't count God out. God's at work. It's just that we're not always at work the way we need to be. But anyway, thanks everybody for coming. Peace on your house and may God be with you. God bless. For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.